I'm on fish, 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 fish. I'm going fishing, hook, sinker, and line.
Okay, you lucky devils. Guess what? We're back. I don't know where we went or where we've been or how we got there or how we got back, but somehow or another, it all seemed to work out. All-star cast today. Yes, indeed. An all-star cast, I'm going to tell you. Fish and Frank here in the chair. Robert in the chair across from me, and RJ trying to control the chaos back up there in the control booth. We've got Captain Morris Campbell here with us today. We're going to be talking about what is and what is not good fishing, where to go, what to do. Robert, to get into the fishing, harbor fishing right now, what's up with that?
Tarpon fishing is by far the best thing going on. I mean, these last several days I've had a lot of reports from multiple people throughout the entire harbor. It's like they've split up. There's a big heavy concentration over on the west wall between the middle of the west wall and that 6 to 8 feet of water all the way up to the mouth of the Myakka. But there's a lot of fish throughout the 20-foot holes, a lot of singles and doubles on the east side, all the way down to two pines.
All the way down, now, they were doing real good on two pines a week or two ago.
Right.
The tarpon were really kicking butt down there.
And they disappeared for a few days, but now they're back.
Right.
And the cool thing about those fish is that from basically burnt store down to two pines, those guys are catching them on thread fins, which are not too bad in numbers down there. You can sabiki up or cast net, ladyfish, and also artificials. Versus the ones inside the harbor are more focused on the artificials or ladyfish. Even if you catch thread fins, they aren't hitting them as good.
Now, Morris, any red tide out there around Boca right now?
Yeah, unfortunately, that red tide moved in this week from the north, and it's really bad in Placida Harbor and north Boca Grande
so
area.
So it's showing back up again.
Yeah, there were... a lot of dead fish in there, fresh deads that were had just come up to float, and still had plenty of color in them.
Boca Grande Pass itself, is that kind of nasty, or is the pass?
It's in there one day, it's not in there the next day. You know, with this westerly wind we're having the last couple days, it could have really pushed it in hard.
Okay, so red tide, bad but sporadic. That's
a pretty good way I've been hearing it too.
Yeah, when it's on there,
all the way up
when
to
it's,
Stump Pass.
Yeah.
So from what I'm hearing, it's from Boca Grande up north towards Stump Pass. I'm not hearing about too much south of there though.
No, they apparently have a little bit of it down in Estero, and Bonita Beach and south, but not to the degree that Boca Grande to Englewood
okay.
had.
So I got to talk just for a second. I'm going to be real quick about it. The pink elephant in the room, and with the rosy red behind, is if the Caloosahatchee is causing that red tide, how is it occurring upstream from there?
Wind.
The wind blowing it north?
Yeah.
So the wind's been blowing out of the south?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before this front came, we had days on end of just light south wind blowing.
Okay, well, I'll go with that, because I've still been trying to figure out, because the Caloosahatchee is responsible for every bad thing that happens right now.
No,
and
no, we've also had an enormous amount of rain.
Coming down the Peace River and the Myakka River.
Absolutely, and traditionally, after our rainy season is when we would normally have a red tide.
Because... for me, when the Caloosahatchee's the villain in the thing for red tide, it's definitely the villain on the blue-green algae. But as far as the red tide goes, usually the Caloosahatchee causes red tide around Punta Rasa, just outside Sanibel, down to Estero. That's where the Caloosahatchee is 99% of the time the culprit for causing red tides. But Boca Grande, Stump Pass, and all that, I think it's pretty much impossible. There's a slight probability to that, but the current along the coast runs from north to south. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that current runs north to south.
The loop current does flow north to south.
And if you go swimming at Englewood and you get in the water, you're going south.
Yeah.
You don't go
the littoral flow is normally, in that direction. There are times early in the season when the loop current first swings in and right. matches up with cooler water, which is April and May, that you get a reverse current. The loop current's flowing south very hard against a colder water body that actually flows north. It's pushing it out of the way. That's the only exception to that, and that happens every year, April, May. You'll get this
so
current.
So it is possible that current was, surface waters were flowing north during that time.
It does happen, and especially the time of year, and that kind of coincided with that. I would say the red tide outbreak, this massive red tide outbreak that we had, was in part due to Caloosahatchee, but it was also due in part to just a massive runoff from higher than normal rain.
I would think the main culprits for that red tide around Boca Grande and Gasparilla is 99% of the time the Peace River and Myakka River.
There's a lot of fertilizers coming out of there, too.
I mean, that's a lot of agricultural property, a lot of swamp land, a lot of manure from all the creatures and all
phosphate.
That. Phosphate mines up there, all the rest of that stuff.
And all the gated communities that line the harbor with all the little creeks and streams and mm-hmm. everything else.
Gated Everybody. Communities are a problem because rich people don't like brown lawns in the winter.
Got to fertilize
So they got to fertilize their grass, keep it green. They pay people to keep those green lawns green. That's a lot of extra fertilizer. So kind of rich folks and agriculture will provide the most of it. But then there's also the septic tanks from my house and everybody else's house and a lot of other stuff that provide, realistically, fertilizer for a lot of this stuff. But anyway, getting into there, what, Morris, you been in the harbor?
I have not been up in the harbor.
Okay, you been in the ICW, anywhere like that?
I've been in the ICW all around Boca Grande, Placida Harbor. And, you know, right now it's basically a red tide event in that area. You can't keep bait alive. You can keep shrimp alive, but you can't find a whole lot to eat the shrimp.
Okay. RJ, you've been under the weather, kind of sick, and not really up to going out fishing, but there was a shot. Did you get out at all?
No, I didn't get out at all, but I was thinking I was going to blame red tide for the way that I'm feeling because it just seems to be politically correct.
Yes. Well, we're going to blame Reb Tide and Caloosahatchee and Lake Okeechobee
okay.
and Big Sugar for your cold.
Big Sugar.
Yeah, yes. sure makes me feel better.
Yes, that's what happened to
Are
it.
Part of the Me Too movement?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, all of it's at fault, but there has to be some reality checks in there somewhere.
Absolutely.
Because I mean, let's face it, the Caloosahatchee has been emptying Lake Okeechobee since 1939. And every few years we go through this because somebody notices, gee, the water's brown in the summer. All right, let's see. I didn't get out fishing. I was at ICAST. We went up to the international something for something, but basically what ICAST is the largest fishing tackle trade show in the world. And you go there looking for stuff, trying to find new items. And what was kind of weird this year was, like, Penn had a really big booth. That was pretty cool. And Rapala had some. Pradco's was a little smaller than normal, who has Bomber, Arbogast, Hedden, and all them. A lot of companies buying a lot of companies.
Yeah.
I mean, There's not a lot of, well, I can't say that, because there's a whole bunch of little companies all over the place.
Sure, but there's a lot of big corporations that are buying out smaller companies and putting them under one big umbrella, and sometimes it's hard to keep up with it.
Yeah. And what's weird about it is, like, Akuma and Savage were kind of in the same thing here in the U.S., but then Savage and Akuma are very separate companies in Europe, and they're splitting here in the U.S. So Savage is no longer going to be under the Akuma umbrella in the U.S. They're going off on their own, setting themselves up. They're bringing out a lot of new baits. We bought a couple of them,
yeah.
A couple of new baits. They got a couple of segmented. Boy, segmented is a big word on lures right now. Back in the late 80s, or mid-90s, I guess it was. Were you at the store when the segmented baits were a big thing?
No.
Okay, then it was definitely the late 90s. And in the 90s, people wanted four or five pieces on a lure. A lure came out on TV, and it was in all the magazines. It was banned in all the tournaments. It was just pure propaganda. Mm-hmm. And remember, I remember guys buying these from the magazines and TV, you know, infomercials, and they would throw it, and if it landed so it, with the belly hitting the water first, it went in and it swam back, and it could actually catch fish. But if it landed on its side and kind of belly flopped sideways, the lure would literally break. And but it caused a big thing. Everybody wanted segmented lures because they swim so much better and they got more action. Well, they do when you're holding it.
Right.
But actually, in the water, very few segmented baits have the action of a single jointed lure. I mean, very few.
Right.
Now, we bought, what was the name of that one company we went to look at where Barry's working now? W something?
Yeah.
I can't remember. But anyway.
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head real quick.
We bought a couple new ones in the, whatever the name of that company is. Then we bought some of the new Savage segmented lures because everybody's asking for them. So we're going to be pretty heavy into that. But one of the best, I would say, we already stock, and that's the Voodoo Mullet.
Yeah, the Voodoo is unbelievable.
And if you're getting into big lures, nothing beats the Savage Trout.
Right.
That Savage, it looks, it's a mullet, it's a trout, whatever it is. If you see it on the wall, it, and I literally was talking to the CEO of the company, and I was telling him, I said, you know,
Weston.
Oh, Weston Lures.
It's a Swedish. Swedish company, I think, or
could be. I don't know.
It's a Northern European company.
All right, because Weston to me sounds like it should be from New Mexico or Colorado or something. But
they're going to.
I'll go with the Sweden thing.
They're going to become big here in the U.S. because they're starting to, like you said, you know, a lot of companies are big in European, starting to come over here, just like us going over there. They're starting to bring their product here into the U.S. So hopefully, by the beginning of the year, we should have all of that stuff.
Yeah, that's why. I always watch what happens at FTEX. FTEX is the European version of ICAST. So I see what's really hot at FTEX, which is the end of June, beginning of July. It's about 3 weeks before ICAST hits. I watch what happens there. I get all the news reports and the articles and everything from FTEX. So I know what I should be looking for at ICAST because that tells me what's hot over there. And eventually it always comes here, like split butt rods.
Oh, yeah.
When I first started selling fishing poles, there was no such thing as a split butt, where you had the cork by the, where you hold on to the reel, and then there's a segment of blank rod and a little bit on the end of it with the more handle, mm-hmm. but you have a space in between, so you have full butt and split butts. And I remember when we started getting them all, I called Ralph, a guy I used to work for in Germany, when I was selling tackle in Europe, and I said, Ralph, do you are getting all, you know, full butt rods over there? Is that? He says, yeah, this year everybody came out with the full butt. I said, yeah, because we got all the split butt rods over here.
Yeah.
Everybody's making split butt rods. The only good thing they're really good for is to lighten the weight up a little bit. They do lighten the weight up, and if you've got a big fish on, sometimes, depending on the person, some people works better, some people works worse, is control of the fish. Sometimes that split butt makes the rod a little more controllable under a heavy load. Sometimes it makes it way worse.
Yeah.
But that's an individual thing. That has nothing to do, one's not better than the other. It just worries about, is it better for you?
Yeah. Personal preference.
Personal preference is exactly it. But the Voodoo Mullet is an extraordinary segmented bait. It's got tremendous action to it. They're, what, 2-3 inches long?
2.5 to 3.5 inches long.
Yeah. Nice.
And they're
great bait.
They have the Kevlar threading in their segments too to help hold it together to make it stronger, because that's been some of the hardest problems with a lot of soft plastics, where they've got any type of connecting point, they tend to pull apart pretty easy, mm-hmm. whether it's a worm or a crawdad, any of that stuff.
That was the problem with the old segmented lures. They just fell apart right away.
Yeah, one fish, and if you were lucky, you got one fish on it, and it was done.
Yeah. Most of the newer stuff either has Kevlar reinforcing or wire through of some description or another. Mm-hmm. But they're actually becoming baits that are actually viable. One lure that I was impressed with is the lure with the dumbest name on the planet, and it's a Rapala lure, and it's called a twitching mullet, and I guess twitching whitebait didn't sound as good,
right.
But they brought out a new, smaller version of it. We've got them coming. We've got all the colors coming because they're absolutely, where the first ones were a little bit too big, and they had a little bit too much flotation in them. They're great in super shallow water, but really hard to use if you got into 4 foot of water. If you were in a foot, foot and a half over the grass, they were awesome. But as soon as you got in that 2.5, 3 foot, couldn't get them into water really enough to work them. You had to go a little too fast with it and a little too much flotation. Guys were catching fish with them, but they really had to work at it, keep your rod tip real low to the water, right at the surface, twitching them. If you brought your rod tip up to even waist high fishing on the boat, the lure was so shallow you really weren't catching much but trout. Now with these new ones, got a little less flotation, they go down a little bit more, they twitch. I think this is, I would say, probably the first one to come out that's actually going to give the MR17, the mirror lure, run for its money.
Absolutely.
And the colors are spectacular.
Yeah, the finishes on them are so realistic looking, it's pretty crazy.
Have you seen those yet, Marsh?
I have seen those. They look amazing. And they're not a mullet, but they sure look amazing.
Yeah, dumbest name ever. I mean, that thing looks as much like a mullet. Well, I might look a little bit like a mullet, but let's say as much like a mullet as RJ does. And RJ doesn't look like a mullet at all. So,
right.
Stupid name, great bait. Let's see. One of the things that I really noticed about a lot of the lure companies is how expensive a lot of these new companies are.
Yeah. Yeah, you pointed that out out to me, you know, a couple of years ago when we were trying to talk about it. And why is this lure manufacturer so expensive compared to, say, Rapala or some of the ones that have been around for decades?
Bomber, Arbogast, Hedden, Mirror Lure, all these companies produce these amazing lures for less than $10, $10 or less.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
Most of the new lures are $10, $11, $12, $14.
$20 isn't even that uncommon anymore.
We saw that one for $35, $36. The guys were asking for it.
But it's just, I mean, it seems like
$36 for a lure. You know how much I would scream?
But it seems like the average price of a new lure nowadays for those guys is that $15 to $20.
$15 to $20. Now, Morris, you were involved pretty heavily when Bagley's was taken over.
Yes.
And wasn't that the actual one of the family from Rapala?
I had the good fortune of meeting and actually fishing multiple times with Yarmo Rapala, who was, you know, the grandson of the original Rapala. His grandfather, you know, carved the first Rapala lures, and you know, the entire Rapala thing is built on quality control. I mean, their stuff is, you know, everything is precise, and all the lures should swim perfectly. And you know, if you go back to Yarmo and his grandfather and the way his grandfather taught him to hand carve baits, the first thing they would do would take a bait out of a package or a box, and they would run it in the water, see how it ran, and then if it wasn't precise, they would take a knife to it and trim that bill up, trim the lure, because lures were made of balsa then.
Right.
And it was all about making something that swam perfectly in the water and didn't act weird.
That was the one thing about the original twitching bait they had. It was the original twitching mullet or whatever it was. When they went to two single hooks on it, they took the treble hooks off of these. Actually saw a guy with the single hook in his hand.
Really?
Yeah, two single hooks, not the with the twitching mullet. He actually got stuck by the front hook and ended up having to go get it removed from his finger. And I said, you didn't think about just bending the barb down on that front hook? I said, that's what I usually do, because whether it's a treble hook in the front or a single hook in the front, it's that front hook which 99% of the time sticks the guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I bend the barbs down on the front hook and leave them on the back hook, because that's the one usually in the fish anyway. But yeah, he actually got stuck with a single hook lure. I was like, wow, that took some effort.
He had to really try for that.
Yeah, and then he was going to get the hook out, forgot the other end was still attached to the fish, so he dropped the fish to go grab the hook. That really put it into there. It was,
jeez.
Oh yeah, that was bad, bad, bad. But anyway, I would say, I was thinking for a while that these companies are just ripping people off, they're charging too much, they're greedy, and all that. And the more I got to think about it, and you know, Morris, that when you have an older company, they already own the factory, they own the machines, they've got the distribution set up, they own their own trucks, they've been doing this a long time. If you got a new company, the price you have to pay for a building and a truck and to get distribution out there, you can't do it on a dollar, you know, 75 cents or a buck a lure.
No.
You've got to make some money on this.
The startup costs are enormous, something like that.
I mean, just between the molds and going over and trying to get everything set up, the startup cost is astronomical, and the price per lure to get a warehouse to put them in, to store them, and then you've got to pay for that UPC barcode that has to be registered. You've got to insure the lure against somebody suing you in case they go out and don't throw it all day, don't catch a fish, and they want to sue you.
Mm-hmm.
You've literally got to be insured about that stuff. So it's an astronomical expense for a new company to start
up.
Where an older company, everything's already there. They've kind of absorbed it in as the years go by. You know, they're replacing this or replacing that. But those buildings are long paid for. They're just paying the taxes and insurance now. They're not having to actually pay for a new multi-million dollar building.
Right.
And a building that would cost $50,000 40 years ago now costs $1.5 million, you know.
And the investment money is way more expensive now. You're not going to find that kind of money from a bank. You're going to get it out of investment capital groups. And it's expensive. It's really expensive.
You gotta pay a lot.
So you got a lot of money to pay back just in interest and fees. So
there really, I don't think there's a way a new company's going to come out. If they produce a lure for $10 or less, it's a miracle.
Well, the trick is going to be to see if they last. You know, can you sell a lure for $35? I was just thinking, if I had a $35 lure, I would only fish it with wire line and then in the swimming pool where there's no fish to grab it.
Right. I was thinking to myself.
I would just want to watch it go. That's it. Don't stay away from my lure. Don't be biting it.
Yeah, I just want to throw it a few times, but I don't actually want anything to hit it where they could take it away.
Yeah, you know, back in the early 70s, the lure that actually started a craze was the Big O, the original hand-carved Big O's made out of balsa with a little printed circuit board for a bill. It was a crankbait, and you have millions of crankbaits produced today, but the Big O was the one that started the whole crankbait craze by winning. You know, the guy that had carved it for his friend literally named it after his friend, and his friend was winning bass tournament after bass tournament with this, and it was not a fluke. It was a crankbait, you know, the very first one that was primitive in nature, and it was a supply and demand that drove the price up for that. Back then, the guys were paying $25 to $30 a piece for these hand-carved Big O's, and you know, as they were mass-produced, Cotton Cordell bought the rights out to produce that, and then they started producing them in plastic. And as soon as that was bought out, then every manufacturer had a big alphabet lure. They were known as alphabet lures back
right.
in the day, and the only company that actually seized that opportunity and made a bait that was actually as good or probably even better was Bagley, because they had a guy named Lee Sisson up in Winter Haven, Florida, that was carving these lures for Jim Bagley, and he copied that and improved it, and they made the Balsa B, and that was, you know, another lure that was, it was kind of like the Yuzuri was a few years back. You know, it was always, it's quite expensive lure. It's more expensive than the other lures. But, you know, traditionally it's supply and demand. But now it's not supply and demand on it. It's initial startup capital that is driving the cost of these
right.
lures up.
I have lures from hand-carved in Okeechobee that they actually did snake skin on them.
Mm-hmm.
Literally cured the snake skin and covered the lures with it. And the story is, when they first started out, they didn't realize it was illegal to use wild snakeskin. And they had endangered species, they had whatever they felt. If they caught a snake, they killed it, tanned the hide, put it on the lure. They were expensive. But I've got some in a glass case from there that actually have real snakeskin on them. And they're pretty cool.
They are.
But I actually paid quite a bit for them, and I won't let anybody fish them. No. They've never hit the water. They hang on their little thing, because I'm not, I had a lot of money to go out and throw in the water. Getting back to the fishing for a minute, how are the redfish doing?
They're starting to pick up pretty good. Lil and her girlfriend yesterday went out, and they actually caught two really nice ones. They caught one that was about 20 inches, and then one that was just right on the high side, right at 26 and a half inches. A lot of customers are going out, and, you know, there's no longer those 20 and 30 redfish days, but catching, you know, half a dozen redfish right now is not that uncommon in a good day's a good day of fishing. West Wall, East Wall, both are doing pretty good. You're working hard for them, but they are nicer fish. You know, they're catching them on shrimp. Cut mullet and cut ladyfish seem to be working good, and a couple guys are doing good on crabs also. You know, the crabs require a little bit more patience for people, so I think that's why less people use them, even as great as, you know, blue crabs work. You know, unless you're Carl, who's the redfish king with that stuff, but blue crabs are really an amazing bait this time of year. And the biggest key that people have to do with these redfish right now, fish it very slow to the point of stop. And if you're working a bush or a shoreline or a little cut or whatever, and you cast that bait in there, you let it sit for a while. Let those pinfish or other little critters come out and peck at it for a little bit. Get that scent going. If you want to reel it back, you reel it back at a slow retrieve and then cast it right back into that same exact spot and let it sit for another couple minutes, because some of those fish are 5, 10, 15 feet up into those mangrove roots or a little bit ways down current. And with that dark black water, they're going by smell. And it takes them a little while to slowly meander around to follow that scent trail up to that bait to focus in and find it. Guys that are casting out and letting it sit for a minute, reeling in, and then casting to the next spot 10 feet away, they're missing those fish that have finally wandered to that spot. It's hot. The fish are slow moving. They're not going to be aggressive. They're going to take their time to try to get to that guaranteed food source. So be patient and it'll pay off.
Right now it's not about sight or sound, it's about smell. Hot, fresh water does not hold a lot of oxygen. The fish are very uncomfortable. It's like you being outside at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and trying to shovel or rake or do something like
just
that.
Just simple, you know, act of mowing the lawn.
Yeah, just getting out there to do anything. You run out of breath quick. It's hard to get out there and do that stuff. And it's the same thing for the fish. They want to eat, they'd like to eat, but they're going to meander over, they got to find it, they got to go, okay, well, I can smell it stronger here, they go a little ways further, no, not as much, they come back, they might go past the scent, they've got to key in on that scent, actually find it through smell, and it's sometimes a lot harder than you would think as the smells travel through water. So dead bait, much more effective than live bait right now.
Absolutely.
So even if you're catching live white bait, you're probably going to end up cutting them in half anyway. So I would, you know, fresh bait is always great, but I wouldn't rely on that live bait fish, even live shrimp. You're almost better off with some frozen or just some fresh dead.
Yeah.
What have you been, you've been out fishing, anything been working for you, Morris?
Well, on the shrimp thing, you can cut those fresh shrimp up and literally throw them. You know, if you have a chum bat, use that. You can throw them by hand, but throw them into the area you're doing. Season up the area. You can even dice up a few of those little pieces of ladyfish and put them in the area and increase that. But you need to be willing to put your power pole down, put your anchor down, and stay put. And like Robert was saying, you know, you need to keep your baits in an area where they're going to get found, and it may take a little time. You know, the fish are cold-blooded creatures, and this time of the year the water temperature approaches almost 90 degrees. Their metabolisms are sky high out through the roof, and they need to eat, so they are going to eat. They're just not comfortable doing it because they're not used to you know, being 90-degree creatures. They're used to being 60- and 70-degree creatures.
Well, anything besides the redfish heading up in the harbor?
Yeah, there is.
How's the snook fishing doing, by the way?
Quite a few little guys around. I haven't heard of a lot of big fish around. But the little peanut snook in that 15 to 26-inch range, they're pretty plentiful.
And but those little snook, you could almost go back to the live white bait, but we were doing real good on crabs cut in half. We were hitting them on that. They love those crabs when they're dead, stinking real bad.
Yeah, this is the time of year where they'll take dead bait readily, just the same reason as the redfish. It's hot. They want that guaranteed meal, so they rely on that scent a lot more. I mean, you'll obviously catch better numbers of them because they are a little bit more abundant, and the little guys are stupid and a little bit more aggressive, so you will catch them on more of a variety of stuff. But the better quality fish are definitely coming on the dead baits.
Well, it's like if you got me sitting in a park and you got a bunch of 14, 16-year-olds there, something happens on the other side of the park, I may walk over, I may not. But every one of them is going to get up, run, and, oh, look at that, run! I'm still deciding if I even want to look.
That's right.
You know, I got to turn my head and everything to do that.
Right.
Yeah, some of the snook we were catching were spitting up crabs. You know, live. You know, they'd obviously eaten live crabs, and the crabs were flowing out at Boca Grande Pass really hard and have been. Even out in the Gulf when we're fishing, out 80 miles, we got pass crabs floating around out there. So there is a ton of crabs being flushed in and out as well. So, you know, snook, redfish, trout, they all love crabs.
It's surprising. People don't think of snook fishing. Years ago, crabs were normal bait for snook fishing. If you were looking for big snook, I would say the most common thing we used to do was watch where the crabbers launched their boat.
Yeah.
And when the crabber would come back in and they cull their stuff there at the dock a little bit more, they kind of do it on the water. But usually when they're loading their boat, they kind of cull a little bit more. We'd take chunks of blue crabs over there, wherever that boat was coming up, and pitch them right in when they launched their boats. And that was usually a big snook. Usually you get a big one out of that just by paying attention because they love those crabs.
Absolutely.
Now, Morse, have you done anything Bull Bay, Turtle Bay, Pine Island Sound down there?
I have not. You know, before the red tide hit, I was fishing a lot, and it was starting to really show. There were some really good redfish and everything, but as of the last 2 weeks, no. We put the little boat up, actually. It was so bad out there.
Okay. Speaking of which, at ICAST, came across, and RJ, you're going to love this. You've got that scientific, I want to know how it works and all this. It's going to make you, you know, really think on this. A guy's got a soft plastic lure. It's called Smart Baits. Now, I met this guy 3-4 years ago at ICAST and just literally fell in love with the concept. I love the lures. I thought this was awesome. What a brilliant move. And what it is you throw them out and say they're green chartreuse. And as it goes down in the water, it turns red. It's the temperature. If you get a 5-degree temperature change, that lure actually changes color to the temperature of the water. And a lot of fish will do that. You get fish that if they come up by the surface, they actually get lighter. And as they dive mm-hmm. down.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, easy for me to say. I get big words and I can say all kinds of things. Okay. But this lure literally changes color as the temperature of the water changes color. And if you can kind of hit that between, it's a combination of two or three colors. And I don't know what it's made out of. I know it's soft plastic.
It sounds like it's a mood ring with a treble hook.
Yeah, that's it's a mood ring that you could put a single or a treble. It has no hooks in it, just a soft plastic curl tail, paddle tail. I actually bought quite a few of them. The guy and I, we've spoke so many times, we've actually become friends. And the problem was they only worked in like 60 and 65 degree water. He didn't have any that would do our water temperatures. He's got them. He's got the hot water temperatures, 90 and 95, 90 and 85. He's got the hot water temperatures. We had a whole bunch of them coming in. And I'm not sure it's going to be a good summertime bait, but once the water chills out a little bit in the winter, you get that nice warm layer on the top, and then as that water goes down into that 5-6 foot of water, it's going to be changing colors. I think it'll work all year in the Gulf of Mexico. If you're trying to get fish that where you cast and allow that lure to go down 20-30 feet, you're going to have that temperature variant. Mm-hmm. And it's going to allow that lure to go from chartreuse to a combination of red and green to straight red, and then as you bring it back up, get the combinations. And I think that could actually, as they see it kind of morphing as it goes down, I think that might be off always. And okay, even if it doesn't catch a fish, it's really cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
Well, the other thing too that might be cool, sorry to interrupt, Morris, is that a lot of fish, when they get excited or stressed, naturally change colors. So that actually might promote a strike from your other predatory fish. I mean, when you're fighting a dolphin, a mahi-mahi, they're pretty much get that brilliant green, yellow look to them. Then when they get gaffed or brought into the cooler, they turn basically blue to almost a blackish color. Sailfish light up with some brilliant pinks and purples in them, but when they're swimming naturally, it's more of a dark blue to a real navy blue, mm-hmm. different shades of blue. So fish light up. Gag groupers are a really good example of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
They sit on a wreck, and they're very, very mottled and dark colored, but when they swim off that wreck and go out onto those sand spots, they'll almost virtually disappear and totally lighten up their colors immensely to the point of almost looking white with very minimal modeling to them. Almost like the chromatophores like in squid or octopus do, the way they can change their colors immediately. These are a lot more subtle.
Now you throw words in there a little bit.
That was a pretty good word. Chromatophore. Yeah.
Chromatophore?
I think that's the right word, that the cells in squid and octopus can change their colors like instantly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll add to that, from diving to deep wrecks down around 200 feet, the amberjacks used to change color when they saw you. You get down deep, and everything is kind of a mottled grayish, bluish, and an amberjack would spot you, and you'd see this yellow flash. They would turn yellow for a minute or so. And I think that was to warn other fish that there was something large coming into the area. So, yeah, the change in color is a big deal.
A lot of fish do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so Morris, what do you think of the idea of the smart bait, where it actually changes color according to the temperatures, where if it's this temperature, it's one color, and as it passes through the different temperatures, it changes?
I think it's a great idea, and like Robert was saying, an excited fish or a scared fish will change colors. Even bait fish will change colors. I've always liked the idea of a bait that changes colors, even going all the way back to the old cotton cordell worms that were chocolate brown, but when you looked at them from the bottom, they were bright purple.
Okay. So, yeah, I never fish much with the cotton cordell worms. I started out with, like, the man's jelly worms, and then went to the culprits, and there was another company that was real big for a little while. I forget the name of it, but they were from the middle, over in the middle of the state somewhere, and I don't remember the name of it. I fished that one for a long time. And then, of course, the old Osuns before David died. Mm-hmm. Once David passed away, no more Osun lures.
Right.
Let's see. Okay, I'm going to use that this segue. Color changing, going to be a little better in the Gulf of Mexico. What's going on out in the Gulf of Mexico? Robert, why don't you talk about a fish and have Morris tell us how to catch it?
We'll go right into what he's going to know best, because he's absolutely amazing. Offshore, is a lot of guys going out there to go bottom fishing are coming across all these dolphin, mahi-mahi, dorado, whatever you want to call them, of assorted sizes. Usually we hear about all the peanut dolphin out there, the little 10 to 15 inches, but we're hearing of 20, 25, 28-inch dolphin out there coming around in schools of all these anglers that are out there trying to chase red snapper, red grouper, and gag grouper, 25 to 45 miles out. Quality dolphins. So,
Morris, have you noticed, is it my imagination, this is the best year for larger dolphin I can remember?
No, absolutely not. I've been catching big dolphin out here since the early 80s.
And let's take you out of the equation.
But how about everybody else that's not Morris?
Now, let's talk about the dolphin fishing out there. Okay. Because Robert said a very important point, which helps give credit and merit to what you just said about this being the best year. People are out there fishing for red snapper and grouper and are seeing these. Okay. They are actually fishing for bottom fish. Therefore, they're not usually prepared to catch mahi, and you wouldn't go out and anchor up and put a bait out for mahi or dolphin or dorados. You would actually go out and troll baits for those in the same areas that you would catch the other fish. Those are known areas for those by a lot of folks that actually do this.
But you're talking 35, 40, 45 miles out.
We have some of the finest dolphin fishing you could ever encounter out there. We have world-class weed lines. I would say that quality dolphin fishing starts off of our southwest Florida coast in 120 feet of water.
Okay, but how far out do you go to hit 120 feet?
It's 40 miles, 35, 40 miles.
But that's what I'm saying.
Right,
you're
going to
go out
about
35, 40 miles. If you're a group of fishermen who historically goes out 15 miles, 20, 25, you're going to have to push that little bit further to get out there to see where those mahi-mahi are. How consistent are they throughout the year?
They're very consistent, but you have to fish for them. If you're going out grouper fishing, they're kind of hit and miss. And the reason being, if they don't come up around your boat, you never encounter them. And you need to cover water to find them and look for things that hold them. Any floating debris out there, sargasso weed lines. Everybody says, oh gosh, there was so much weed out there, I couldn't get my bait down or up without snagging weed. And you know, then they say, oh, and then a dolphin came around the boat. Well, hello.
You drive all the way to the Keys, spend 4, 5, 6 hours in the car, dragging a boat all the way down there. You get down there, you go out in the Atlantic, you look for weed lines, you have no idea where you're going, but you just head out looking for them. Then you find the weed lines and you start fishing and you catch mahi-mahi. And I've done that even in an 18-foot boat. I've been 40, 45 miles out in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Never thought anything about it. But when you get here to the Gulf Coast, people say 40, 45 miles. I mean, oh my God, you got to have an 80-foot boat. You've got to. And yeah, I'm building a flats boat, a 24-foot flats boat. So when the days are nice, I can run out there because it costs me pennies to run compared to what an offshore boat
is. Absolutely.
And now I'm building the deck so that if it even the cockpit area fills up with water, it's just going to drain out. I'm just going to keep driving. It ain't going to make a bit of difference.
Well, what we have now, we have all these new boats with increased range due to the four-stroke motors and bigger capacities of fuel, and people are regularly going out 40, 50, 60 miles fishing for red snapper and grouper and exploring deep water bottom, and they're encountering these fish that have been there the whole time. I've been catching these fish routinely every year since the early 80s, and as far as dolphin, I mean, our biggest dolphin ever that I've ever had anybody catch at all was caught in the Gulf of Mexico, and it was 71 pounds.
71 pounds?
It was a 71-pound dolphin.
Mahi in the Gulf of Mexico.
And that was weighed on certified scales.
Okay. RJ, do you do any mahi-mahi in the Gulf of Mexico?
No, I've never done it in the Gulf of Mexico. I've caught them on the other side.
So you, me, and everybody else, it's not something we think about.
And no, when I hear those stories, right away I'm thinking, oh, is climate change have something to do with this or not? It's not, as Morris will tell you, they've been there all along.
They have, because the Gulf Stream that everybody goes to in the Keys and on the East Coast actually comes from the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf Loop Current, which flows right down our coast. And in the summertime, these people that go out to 80, 100 feet of water, they'll notice the water's pretty blue color. Well, guess where that blue water's coming from? The Gulf Loop Current. And in the dead of winter, when our temperatures are in the upper 50s and lower 60s in here around Boca Grande and offshore, close to shore, it's still in the mid-70s out there in the Gulf Loop Current. And there's still pelagics out there. Their weed lines, all those weed lines come from, they circle up in, from the Caribbean Current into the Gulf of Mexico and right back down, and they make the Gulf Loop.
Basically Brazil all the way up the whole Central American side and then loop around from Texas back down through the Keys.
All right. For anybody who doesn't want to run out that far, Robert, right now I'm going to say Gulf of Mexico, much better fishing than Charlotte Harbor, yes, or the Intercoastal, anywhere else. The water's a lot cooler due to the fact that the water is clear, and solar radiation goes to darker things much better. And clear water kind of passes through or bounces off, and, you know, black piece of paper on the ground versus a white piece of paper. That's what you're really seeing for the solar radiation. Black piece of paper is going to get so hot you don't want to pick it up. The white piece of paper stays cooler. If someone was going to go out, say, 3 to 5 miles out, what could they expect out there?
Spanish mackerel are in pretty good numbers. Even some bonita have been coming in that close. Handful of small sharks. But if you're bottom fishing, you got mangrove snapper, even some lane snapper in that close. Been a few permit, oddball cobia, and even the little grunts and just regular porgies out there. You know, just nice grocery shopping, lightweight rod and reel, basically your snook and redfish tackle is really all you need for out there.
All right, if you're going to go out there, Morris, to fish these near reefs, and let's say you got Mary's or Power Pole, somebody doesn't want to really get out in the Gulf too far, if you're wondering where they are, go on fishandfranks.com, go to the Reefs and Wrecks button, and I've got literally, I show you where it is and show you how far away from the passes they are. So if you're wondering, and I show you how far from land they are, you know, if it's anywhere close. But some of those are literally 3 or 4 miles offshore, which is the same as being in the middle of Charlotte Harbor. If you're right in the center of Charlotte Harbor, you're 3 to 4 miles offshore, off of land. Same thing.
That's correct.
Now, Morris, what size hook, sinker, if you were going to go out and just try and catch some snapper, Mary's, Power Pole, Helen's?
Okay. First thing I would do would be to stop at the bait shop, and I would get a couple bags of chum. That would be my first move.
And frozen blocks of chum?
Frozen blocks of chum.
Okay.
You know, and they come in a mesh bag, or if you have a mesh bag, you can put them in. You go out to these areas, anchor your boat so the stern of your boat, you're fishing just on the edge of these areas. Don't anchor your boat so you're fishing right on top of it.
Yeah, everyone wants to fish vertical on
right
these reefs.
Well, the whole point of this is,
if you drop your anchor right where the fish are, you're probably going to scare a couple of them.
You're probably going to hang your anchor in the reef, you know, lose your anchor, not going to catch a lot of it. So anchor so your boat is on the edge of the reef, wreck, you know, artificial reef, whatever you're going to fish. And like Frank was saying, your inshore tackle for snook and redfish works perfectly. You don't want to go out there with heavy guns. You know, go out there with something with like 15-pound braid or 12 to 14-pound mono. Use a small 1/0, 2/0 circle hook. And take a lot.
I went up to the 2/0 just because I was having, by the time I got the squid, and I like putting a piece of squid and then a live shrimp on.
Okay.
To me, that's my favorite. And if I tried it with a 1/0, I just didn't have enough hook left.
Right. And what I was going to say was that, you know, invest in some live shrimp. Take them out there. All of these snappers are shrimp eaters. You know, if you can find some small pilchards, live white bait, or thread herrings, take some of those too. They bite those just fine. But you know, if you're fishing on my boat and you're out there fishing for snapper, you're going to be using live shrimp, and you're going to say, "Well, I didn't know they bit shrimp like this." You know, my goodness, look at these snappers! And you can go to public numbers, and if you chum and fish light tackle and shrimp, you will catch quality snappers off of it, and you'll catch bonus fish. You'll catch occasional hogfish, you'll catch porgies, you'll catch plenty of gray grunts, Key West grunts, you'll catch small grouper, occasionally you'll catch keeper grouper, all kinds of things, flounders.
Now, when I'm doing it, I take a spinning rod, usually a 10 to 20 pound class, because I want a little tighter action when I'm out there, 3 to 4,000 size reel on it, and or 30 or 40, however you want to look at the numbers, and I put a half, three-quarter ounce sinker on it because I'm in 20, 25 feet of water. I don't really think I need a lot. I use about 2 feet to 30 inches of 30-pound mono or fluorocarbon leader. I don't really think the fluorocarbon's that beneficial out there. And a 2-aught hook. And I literally cast it away from the boat, out towards the current, leave my bail open until I see the line stop moving. I don't close my bail when the bait hits the water, otherwise it sucks it way back towards the boat. It's too much on a pendulum, it's swinging back to me. If I cast it out and I'm trying to cast it farther away from the boat and let it hit the bottom, as soon as my line stops sinking, where I can see the line, I want it to stop sinking, close my bail, tighten up, and I'll wait there for a minute if I don't already have a fish on. And then I'm almost like I'm kind of slow jigging. I kind of tip my rod up, kind of slide it along the back, the bottom of the gulf there. I want it to slide a little bit, hopefully not getting hung up, just to give it a little movement. Now, is that something like you would do more? Now, that's something I've done. I don't know if it's right or wrong.
Right. Well, basically, whatever you have confidence in doing is the right way for you to do something. It may not be the way someone else does it, but if you have confidence in the method.
So what would you do?
Well, I usually snapper fish in a different manner. I take a light in shallow water. I'll take an eighth or a quarter ounce
now,
jig.
Shallow head. Water, 20,
yeah.
20 to 30 feet.
Inside of 50 feet.
Inside of 50 feet.
And I'll use a light jig head or the smallest weight that we can use, usually an eighth or a quarter ounce. And instead of casting out, since we're chumming and the chum is diffusing from the boat back over the reef, I'll place that bait in the water right by the boat where the chum's starting and let it fish all the way back in the chum slick, because the snappers, you can catch snapper on the bottom. Do they lay on the bottom all the time? No. They're following your bait down to the bottom because 99% of the time snappers suspend. They're suspended fish on the reef. So when this bait goes down, it actually fishes the entire water column down, and that way you get bonus king mackerel, bonitas, things that are up in the upper level. At times we have to take the weight off because the big mangrove snapper and yellowtails are eating it 5 feet behind the boat.
Well, that's a pretty, that, you know, I'm sorry you have these troubles.
You can
take the weight off so you can catch the yellowtail snapper and stuff 5 feet away from the boat. God, to have these problems. I mean, his life just as bad, isn't it, Robert?
But yeah. It works for anybody that would do it.
The one thing that I do a little differently, like I've used the jig head technique because you've explained that to me before, but I will sometimes use 30-pound, but I actually like to drop down to like 20-pound leader, and I use a much longer leader, you know, especially fishing some of these near-shore reefs. There's a lot of public pressure. So exactly. Your larger fish definitely are more educated fish. So I like dropping down to like that 20-pound mono or fluorocarbon. I usually make that decision when I get out there, depending on the water clarity. But I'll be using 5 to even sometimes 10 feet of leader and slowly feeding it out into that current and letting it just do its own thing. And when you can put it in the rod holder and leave the bail open, or you can hold it in your hand, but you're slowly feeding the line, and what you do is you watch the line, and the current is pulling it off that spinning reel in pretty much a very distinct manner. It's just rolling off at a nice, even pace, and you can kind of watch it real close, and sometimes you get that half a second pause where it didn't loop off. At that point, I'm closing the bail and starting to reel because a fish probably hit it on the way down. Or you'll actually see the line all of a sudden jump where it takes several coils off and the fish is starting to boogie with it because you've got a lot of slack in the line. So close the bail instantly, and then I just start reeling. And that helps catch some of those larger fish because there's you know, like you said, there's 3 to 5 pound mangrove snapper on some of these very close reefs.
Yes.
And the people are using really heavy tackle are constantly catching the smaller fish.
All right. Well, so I guess it boils down to no matter what you're doing with it, if you're drifting it back with the chum, you drop it on the bottom, I think the best idea is to see which one works for you.
Keep it light, yeah, no matter what you do.
And if you get out deeper, you've got to have a heavier rod, you got to have bigger sinkers, just because, you know, if you do get something, if you're 60 feet up over the top of them, and they're down in the rocks, you're not going to get them out of the rocks. You're just no way to muscle them up that far with that light of a rod. You're going to actually catch a lot more fish if you just work on it that way. But anyway, guys, we've been talking all about kind of what is and what isn't and how everything's going. And Fishing Frank here, Robert in the chair across me, our guest today, Captain Morris Campbell, and as always, RJ trying to control everything. That's just the way he is. So thank you guys for listening. We will catch you next week on Fishing Frank's Radio Fishing.
Just to ease my mind.
Okay, we're clear.